Willkommen zum Podcast der Initiative Regenerative Marktwirtschaft. Hier wollen wir herausfinden, wie eine umweltfähige Zukunft macht.
Welcome to today's episode of the podcast for the Initiative for the Regenerative Market Economy. And this is the first conversation I'm having around season two, which focuses on empowering community into addressing what a good life means for them and getting into coherence around it and getting into action ultimately. And I'm really, really happy to welcome Donny here today. And you can thank Donny for the diverse makeup of season one, because Donny was one of the first people I ever asked to be part of this podcast. And he took a look at the first seven or so episodes and said, dude, these are all white men. I'm not coming onto this before you have some diversity here. So Donny, you triggered that, and I'm really, really grateful for that. But I'm also really, really grateful for you, for us now having time here to explore a little and see how you do things and how you help community. So let's start at the beginning, like we always do, which is, who are you?
Well, hi, Thomas. Hi to your audience. Great to be here with you. Well, I'm a white male. Let's start there. I have a lot of privilege. I'm someone who was born on Cammeraygal land in so-called Sydney in 1982. And I was born in a place that is probably one of the wealthiest suburbs, one of the wealthiest communities in the entire world. So I grew up in this environment where extravagant wealth, as well as conspicuous wealth, like both of those forms were on display. And the way that I feel about myself these days, in terms of how I would describe myself, is that from a very early age, I felt like a systems feeler. And I suspect most children are, you know, someone who feels and senses what's going on around you. So who I am is very much shaped on this experience of internal reflection about the dynamics both within my family and the politics and the power dynamics. And I'm someone who has spent the subsequent decades really seeking to understand myself better and understand the intersection point between what's going on inside my own body and what's happening in the outer world. And of course, still on that journey, will be for the rest of my life, in that sort of examined life, the notion of the interconnections between the inner and the outer worlds. I'm someone who's passionate about music. I love making improvisational songs, a cappella arrangements in particular. I love improvisational theater. I'm a husband. I'm an uncle to four nieces and nephews, both here in Argentina, where I live on Huelche and Mapuche lands these days, with my wife and three cats. And I'm also someone who really relishes, savors looking out the window or being right up next to trees. Green in particular inspires me. I find I get a lot of energy from the trees that I'm looking out on right now, and the birds that are flying nearby as well. So I feel most at home when I'm in some kind of creative flow, or whether that's with an artistic endeavor or having a conversation like this.
Beautiful. Thank you. I love that idea of the systems feeler, and also your assumption that this might be a common thing. I think I have a sense of what you mean, but it would be great if you could elaborate a little bit on what that is in your perspective, as far as this can be articulated. I know that's probably really, really hard, but I'd love for us to get a sense of what is a systems feeler.
Absolutely. You know what? I'm going to do something a little unusual here, especially for a podcast, and I'm going to lead you on an experiment, and for your listeners, on an experiment to answer that question. And to do so, you'll need a pen and a paper. So obviously pause your recording now. If you're listening to this and you're wanting to participate, just go grab a pen and a paper. And I see Thomas is doing the same. So we'll give it just a moment here.
Yeah. Well, I'm running.
And in the meantime, I'll say that for me, systems feeling is about noticing what's happening in one's body, and then the connection between that and the systems that operate internally within us, in terms of the flow between those different feelings, the sensing underneath the emotional state, like what's actually going on here, and then that perception of how things like, for example, someone driving a vehicle that says energy efficient, but is actually much bigger than another vehicle that they previously owned, how that just doesn't add up, right? Like how it just doesn't make sense, you know, and then noticing the feeling and the sensation in the body when that kind of gaslighting might be happening collectively, I would say is how I would describe systems feeling. But outside of that, let's do this experiment to draw open, pun intended, some possibilities here. It's a drawing experiment. So we're going to start by drawing a line down the center of your page vertically.
Okay.
And in the top right, I'd like you to write the word future.
Okay.
And then in the top left, the word present. Mm-hmm. We're going to start on the right-hand side. I want you to imagine a future that's working for everyone and everything, human and non-human species alike, an economy that's working for everyone and everything. Just imagine it for a moment. And when you've connected with some kind of image, drop down into your body, maybe drop your chin a little and drop down into your body and feel it. How does it feel in that economy that's working for everyone and everything? And when you've connected with the feeling, draw a symbol or a shape without lifting your pen that represents how it feels in that economy. Draw a symbol or a shape without lifting your pen that represents how it feels in that economy. Okay, and if you're still doing this exercise now, listening to this, you can pause and take a little longer if needs be. Now we move to the left-hand side. How does the present economy feel? And again, when you've connected with that feeling in your body, draw a symbol or a shape without lifting your pen that represents how the present economy feels. Okay. And again, if you need more time, you can pause the recording. So I've been conducting this experiment for maybe 11 years now, all around the world, probably with more than 10,000 people. And what's interesting about the demographics of who I've conducted this with is that it cuts across just about every kind of difference that I can think of. I've done this with Fortune 500 executives. I've done this with people living on the streets. I've done this in languages other than English. I've done this with people across the political spectrum. Anarchists of all persuasions, free market capitalists, across the gender spectrum, etc. It doesn't matter who I do this with, where I do it, or even what language I do this experiment in, or others who've now done the experiment as well themselves. No matter where or who or how I do this experiment in terms of language, people consistently draw one of five symbols or shapes for the future and one of five symbols or shapes for the present, or a close variation of those. So I'm going to tell you what people around the world draw for the future, and then we'll see what you drew, Thomas, and then I'll talk to you about the present. So for the future, people typically draw a circle. an infinity symbol or a panarchy symbol, a spiral, a nodular blob, sort of like if you throw something against a wall and it splats, or a heart. What did you draw?
Oh, there.
You draw the circle. Okay. Mm-hmm. And for the present, people typically draw a jagged line, an isosceles triangle, a downward arrow, a rectangle, or a mess of lines. What did you draw?
A downward arrow, triangle. Because okay. I was thinking about the or feeling into which direction should that triangle be, and it clearly was down.
Clearly went down. Interesting, interesting. So you drew the circle and the triangle. And what's interesting here is that, and typically I run workshops where people then unpack that for maybe half an hour talking with each other, what was the feeling, et cetera. But one of the things that I find most interesting that speaks to this notion of everybody as a systems feeler is that there is a piece of wisdom that is revealed in that experiment. There is a revealing of an innate understanding of a universal law. And that law that we see in nature is that all things flow, or all things that are healthy, are based on nonlinear principles in terms of circulation. In nature, we see the circulation of carbon, for example, nitrogen, different phosphorus cycles, these sorts of things. And when in nature or in our bodies, which is also another living system that has this principle, whenever we have an accumulation, for example, of blood or an absence of oxygen in certain places in our bodies, we have problems, gangrene, death, etc. Likewise, in nature, when we have the accumulation of something over a period of time in a linear direction, we have problems. Our economy is no different. It is a living system. Whether the fact that it's human-made doesn't change the fact that it is a living system, right? It's dynamic. It's constantly adapting. And therefore, needs to be based on nonlinear principles. Yet our current system, as people draw, you see this difference between the right-hand side where everyone draws something nonlinear and the left-hand side where someone, people, doesn't matter your political beliefs, doesn't matter how much of a capitalist aficionado you are, you're still going to draw that the future is nonlinear if it's working. And the present is linear. That is an example of systems feeling. We know in our bodies certain things about what's happening, whether or not we can cognitively process that to the point of articulating. And so essentially what that means is that when it comes to these bigger questions of the planet, et cetera, and our relationships with the planet, we're all walking around with the same embodied knowledge, the same embodied wisdom, just different levels of cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm.
That leads me directly to the second question I wanted to ask, triggered by how you shared about yourself in the beginning, which is, in that journey of unpacking yourself, of getting a better understanding of yourself over the years since you found yourself to be a systems feeler, have you found it more useful to shed story or to add story?
That's a great question. I'm going to give a response outside of those two, which is I found it most valuable to remember story. And what I mean by that is that I'm in a process of remembering that I'm a systems feeler, that we all are systems feelers. Which of course involves adding certain pieces and shedding certain pieces, but more than anything, what it feels like to me is a returning, turning to something. And in fact, in all of the experiences that I've had in community or organizations or the wider world more generally, what I find is, and I don't feel I'm alone in this, when someone says something truly profound, not just, you know, surface level or gimmicky or a nice turn of phrase that sounds, you know, apparently profound, but something that actually, you know, in your body is like, yes, I resonate. For me, and I believe for others, that's a remembering. That's a, oh yes, that's a, like, it never wasn't there. And I sense that that's the case for so many things in this world. I know in group processes, just, I see, for example, conversations, we use sociocracy at the Post-Growth Institute as a decision-making tool. For those unfamiliar with sociocracy, that's a way to decide collectively about things using a consent model. And what I notice is that in this model, constantly people will be sharing objections to things, right? And in the way that we practice sociocracy, and more generally the way it's practiced, an objection is something to be excited about, because you propose something and then, oh, someone suggests something else might be missing, and you lean in and say, oh, what could I learn here? And in that process, what I notice is that when it's working really well, the things that people add are things that you might not have been able to bring, right? Which is the value of the collective. But they are still things that resonate with people, and they resonate because they're there inside us, and it's someone else needed, you know, whether because of layers of trauma that hold people back from understanding and tapping into things, or lived experience, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You get this beautiful merging of remembering that happens, that allows for the collective co-liberation, that involves the shedding of certain pieces, certain constructs, et cetera, but also the addition of insights, but ultimately all wrapped up in a broader remembering.
That's evokes a picture for me that I've been fascinated with for a while now, which is around our obsession with these quadrant analysis tools, right? You have two axes and two things on each axis, and then you have these four quadrants, and they give you some information or not. And people are using that for known and unknown, and putting, and then getting known knowns and known unknowns and unknown unknowns. But I've never heard anybody talk about unknown knowns. And to me, it sounds like that's what you're addressing, right? Things that we already know are true, but we don't even have them in our conscious vocabulary. So you're pulling them up in these moments of insight, potentially, right? So now I can completely see this on an individual level, right? And you're clearly an example of how to live that, right? How to do that in a life. But you're also here because you also know how to do that on a collective level, right? So the interesting question is, if what you say is true and we have deep innate knowledge that we all share, then it would be very interesting to be able to coordinate that across all 10 billion or whatever we are of us, that then, because ultimately that would probably fix or bring us back, remember us into a modality of being that is more conducive to life. And so it is interesting to me, how do you bring groups of people into coherence around these ideas, around what they already carry, what they might see as a good life, like you imagined, you made us imagine with the future, etc. So what's your procedure there?
Well, I remember about 20 years ago, something very foundational for my present work happening, something very inspiring. I was introduced to a body of work called asset-based community development. And for those unfamiliar, asset-based community development says when you start with what's working, you have a very different outcome to when you start with what's not working. And the common models of community work, organizing, et cetera, are conditioned typically in Western cultures in particular, and through colonialism and neocolonial forms of those practices throughout the world, to start with what's wrong. Where I took that, and building on the work of people like Dee Brooks, who were my early mentors in this space, was I said, what if you applied that to everything? And my reasoning was that the most critical thing for people to be able to come together and develop coherence around a remembering of innate wisdom was for people to feel safe. Safe and seen, right? Seen being part of the safety. And in order to feel safe, humans need to be out of the flight, fight, freeze, and fawn part of the brain. Now, beginning sentences, experiences, projects with what's working, what's good, and what's safe, not only does it take you into the creative neocortex, but it has a deep, deep cross-cultural validation process that taps into our deepest stories. If you think, for example, in cultures that I was raised in about this notion of the hero or heroine's journey, right? That story, and you look at the formula that was used, and you realize that it also goes much deeper than Western or Christian or different forms of traditions, that there's replication of a general narrative, a story arc that is so familiar to us, even with, like, for example, the Disney stories these days. When you look at those stories and you look at the beginning, how do they begin, Thomas? What's the opening way that those stories typically begin in terms of the context?
Well, a challenge, a catastrophe, a problem, and then another one that goes even deeper before we can start the actual story.
So that's super, super interesting that you say that, because my investigation into this is that actually that happens, but something happens before that. Before the challenge, there is a little piece, which is everything is fine. Everything is happy. You know, the character is happy. Well, here lived so-and-so, living a happy, merry life. And then the challenge drops, right? One day, right? Well, it doesn't start with the one day a terrible something hit the village of dot, dot, dot. It starts with, here's the character and everything's fine. And that's how mythological stories often begin, is that everything is okay. And then a challenge. And then the hero, heroine emerges, works through these things. Then there's a setback, etc. And ultimately they prevail. That story arc isn't challenge to solution, which is the way that we are conditioned often through the conversations that get presented to us, or the media that gets presented around the world's challenges and who's going to solve them, how they're going to get solved, etc. Here's a challenge. How do we fix it? Problem, solution, pathology, as I describe it. Instead, it begins with everything's okay. And so then as you lower yourself down into the depths of a challenge that essentially might, you know, push one's psychology into spaces of darkness, so to speak, you know that there is a lifeline that you're returning to, like a bookend. Right? Everything was okay once. Now it's not okay, but it's going to be okay again, right? That power, that deep mythological power, that again is something that I think we hold through millennia of storytelling in all of our genetics and is maintained in many cultural practices, right? The oral traditions in particular. That is powerful because what it does is that it allows people to come together. And if you begin with what's working, you remind them of an aspect of safety that allows them to increasingly drop into their bodies, which is where this wisdom surfaces from. So if you want to get together as a group and decide on things together, the best outcome is going to come when people feel safe enough to drop into their bodies and speak from that embodied space, not higher up in their body, speaking from their trauma response about their emotional experience, but actually, what am I feeling about this proposal, about this idea, about this topic, etc. So the answer that I'm offering here is the openings in all our interactions are critical. What happens in that first few seconds, how we frame things, and I'm thinking here of the work of George Lakoff and the Framing Institute, for example, amazing work that has highlighted aspects of what I'm alluding to here, that framing matters. And if you want to have communities come together and be in the most creative flow practices together, how you begin that process and how you re-begin, whether it's, you know, your initial onboarding or your initial outreach through an email or in a conversation, someone's asking a question of a group, how you respond. You start with a strength. For example, mm-hmm. that's a great question, you know, helps mm-hmm. that person feel safer versus like, I disagree, mm-hmm. you know, immediate differences in the entry points. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just want to reiterate the importance of the point that you made about the fight and flight response versus the relaxation response. Because there is some research happening around our effectiveness in thinking and maybe even in feeling, I don't know, but our effectiveness in thinking when you are in relaxation mode, you're about four times as effective as a agent in the world if you're in relaxation mode rather than if you're in flight response. And that is pretty obvious if you think about it, because in fight and flight response, everything is focused on one single very foundational action, which is run away to keep yourself safe. But if you're already safe, like you say, that unlocks a level of ease in which you can be in a relaxation response and then unlock that creativity. That makes so much sense to me. Okay, so that's a really, really important anchor. And once you, so the framing matters, getting people into safety, ease, relaxation response. What would be a good next step from there to unlock group coherence around the question of a good life?
Yeah, so let's go back to this helpful piece, I think, about what safe really means. In my experience, one of the critical pieces of safety is to feel seen. So I want to share a little story about how the Post-Growth Institute began 15 years ago that I think brings to light these pieces that are universally needed for people, at least universally in so far as I've seen it, for people to come together to explore what a good life means. And so we began as an organization, and I'll tell a little side story here that may become relevant later in our conversation, because we began with 10 people, 9 others that I invited in on a Skype call, and this was 2010. So the video and audio feed across 10 different locations immediately went down. And as a result, something profound happened in those first 20 seconds that changed the course of our direction entirely. Because forced, without any video or audio feed, we were forced to shift. How are we going to communicate? Well, we're going to type. Now, all of a sudden, we're having a type meeting with people we don't know. That's interesting. The power dynamics change entirely. The experience for an introvert, for example, is very different to an extrovert like myself at the time, who is going to be able to speak off the cuff very easily. And so that's just a little side note that we might return to a little later in terms of how do you create spaces that feel safe enough, especially for introversion. That's something that doesn't get a lot of attention in the practicalities. We might touch back on that. But what happened next also was interesting, because I invited the group ultimately to try an asset-based approach. And we began in those first 4 to 6 weeks just by coming up with a questionnaire collectively of things that we wanted to know about each other that we thought might bring forth strengths. Not with an extractive lens though, not like, what can you do that might be helpful for us? But starting with, what are you passionate about that's not related to work, et cetera. Getting to know each other from this space, recognizing that human beings have accumulated all sorts of incredible passions, knowledge, skills, resources, sometimes from even before their birth, and that we are this constellation of beauty showing up in physical form with such breadth that only just gets looked at the very surface and in a very extractive lens in a capitalist patriarchal system. And so what happened next was incredible, because after 4 weeks of doing this exercise, we reviewed each other's answers and we came back in again, still typed. And you could feel it, even though we are typing into a machine and not seeing each other, you could feel the relaxation, you could feel the safety, you could feel the sense of awe and appreciation at the depth of the beauty that had been revealed, which was just still some level, right? Through the reading these answers about each other. Oh my gosh, you're passionate about this. Oh, me too. You know, oh wow, that's interesting. What's that about, etc. This awe and wonder that allowed us to create our starting positions and foundational charter in just a few hours. Why? Because people felt safe and seen. So much of our wounding, my own included, comes from the feeling of feeling unseen. So much white saviorism, so much change the world, so much the comes from this unexamined aspects of what's driving me. Why did I run across Australia when I was a teenager? Because I was trying to be seen. Why did I go do a PhD looking at nanotechnology, an area that I had no background in? Because I was trying to be seen, right? On some level. So for groups to come together with coherence around what the good life looks and feels like can often benefit from starting by saying, what's the good life look and feel like when we see each other in a more in-depth way than extractive capitalistic processes condition us to do, such as, hey, so-and-so, nice to meet you. What do you do?
So you were forced into that situation by technology. That was a fortunate, in hindsight, fortunate event. How did you extrapolate from that into the development of tools that create these kinds of situations, even in high immersion physical meetings, where the down regulation of extroverts is a bit harder? how do you go about these physical meetings?
That's a great question. We pinpointed very early on that for us, one of the greatest leverage points globally right now is to enhance the quality of facilitation, community facilitation. And so we've dedicated much of the last 15 years to sharing and experimenting and in a process of ongoing learning, helping others and ourselves learn how do you create the safest, most creative containers possible. And this practically plays out in our offers and needs market, for example, where we have almost 400 facilitators around the world trained in this 2-hour process in person or virtually to explore and bring forth what people's passions, knowledge, skills, resources, needs, et cetera, are in communities. And it's a successful methodology. Why is it a successful methodology? Because it has design secrets underpinning it that are secrets, coming full circle, are things that were felt into, not thought into. So if you look at, for example, the application of parallel processing and you realize that if you have a circle and you say to the circle, okay, we're going to share offers and needs, like, okay, a gift circle kind of style. Everyone goes around and shares one thing they're offering or needing. Immediately you've split the process there. And it's more powerful to say, everybody reflect just on what you're offering, where you get that group coherence of an activity where you're all focused on the same thing. That kind of thing is universal in my experience. It cuts across cultural, demographic differences. There is a power in giving people an attentiveness to a collective process simultaneously. Let's all reflect on this same thing at once. Likewise, thinking about the phasing of processes. So, for example, if you and I are to be in community together, we might have different levels of comfortability with offering or needing. In fact, in my experience, in most Western cultures, people are much more comfortable offering things than asking for what they need. Right? Yet you'll see in most technologies, and I'm thinking here about digital technologies as well as social technologies, you won't see a clear differentiation between those two things in terms of phasing. You'll see like Facebook Marketplace will have like offering and needing at the same time, et cetera. That sensitivity to the sensitivity around the differences, people's comfort levels around each, is built into our process. We begin purposefully with what you're offering. Why? Because if you can actually realize you have something to offer others from the beginning, it creates part of that safety of feeling seen so that you feel more comfortable to go into the uncomfortable spaces of what you need, the vulnerabilities. So these pieces, this facilitation dynamics, thinking about and feeling into the lived experience of what makes people feel safe. And actually, I'll give one last example on this. I remember being at an event years back where someone asked, as is common in progressive spaces at the beginning when they're creating a container, they'll say something like this: what would everybody need in order to feel safe today? Right? People, you might be listening to this and go, yeah, I've heard that expression before. Interestingly, that's a deficit framing, right? What do you need? What do you not have? So I came into this exercise and I said, would you be okay with us trying something a little different here? And the facilitator, I was co-facilitating, and my co-facilitator said, sure. And I said, okay, here's a little reframe on that. What have you found helpful, or what has previously enabled you to feel safe in environments like this? And then people reflected on that, shared that. And now you're building a container based on what you know has worked for people. And it was so much more creative than my experiences of what do you need, right? What do I need to feel safe? Well, I don't know. I don't even know who these people are. Like, where do I begin? What has worked for me in the past? Well, when we all said our names, where are we coming from? You know, like, I want to know where people live. That helps me. Whatever it is, it's very grounded, very practical. It's sort of building on things like appreciative inquiry. So that's my long answer to your question about these container creating processes.
It's beautiful. It makes so much sense to me. And it's brought up the memory of a design sprint we ran many years ago on the question of how can we create support structures for elderly people to live longer and better at home. And we had one assumption that we tested, which was that people would be willing to help elderly people in a community setting. And we were extremely surprised at the fact that we had enormous amounts of people signing up to support elderly people, but hardly any elderly people wanting support. And as we drilled into this, we found that our actual target group, the elderly people, were the ones offering the support, because that was healing their own need by supporting others. I found it very interesting. That came up while you were while you were speaking.
I see that with my father-in-law here. You know, he gets so much more out of helping us when he's visiting than he might gain from having support in terms of his physical challenges, et cetera, even though my wife and I are trained as kinesiologists, right? So you're absolutely right. And it touches on this interesting point about what does it take to be able to unlock the vulnerability that's there for the needs, because you cannot coexist, you know, an offer is a need on the other side of the coin.
And you have to be, as a facilitator, basically, you have to be a step ahead, right? You have to go into courage and into your strength. in order to be able to do that, to be able to do get step into the potential vulnerability to open the space for others. And there's I found it fascinating that, one of these random encounters, somebody was coming to fix the heating system in our home, and we were chatting, and for some reason we got into a conversation around his grandmothers. And both of his grandmothers used to do an odd thing, a seemingly odd thing. From time to time, they would ask him to go to the neighbor and ask for something, like a liter of milk or some salt or whatever. And he recognized that they had these things at home. They didn't need them. And so he asked, why are you doing this? Why are you sending me over there? And both of them had the same stance. They said, if I don't need anything from them, how will they ever have the courage to come over and once need help from us, right? So somebody has to open that circle, yeah, and just say, I need something easy, and that's where it starts, right? So it also can come from need, but it is a constructed need, right? So just for the purpose of initiating.
Let's go one step even further.
Yeah, go ahead.
Martin Prechtel, whom some of your listeners will have encountered, writes about a story, I think it was in Guatemala where he was living, writes about this experience where he was living in this community and he needed some money for building, I think it was the place that he was looking to stay in. And some women in the community lent him the money. And then after the process was finished, he had some money, he looked to repay that debt. And he tells this story from memory where he's seeking to repay them. He takes the money to give them, and they shoo him away with broomsticks, like, get out of here. And he tries it again the next day because he's like so shocked about it. And they do the same thing. And so he talks to somebody. He said, what's that about? He said, no. Here, that indebtedness is the connection, is the relationship, is what is going to maintain the bonds in this community. You don't get to pay that debt back. You are permanently indebted. And now go find someone to be indebted to you.
And if you now replace indebtedness, which always has a negative
repercussions, implications,
with just getting into relation.
Yes.
Right? Getting into relation and accepting that there's a continuous dance around the messiness of life and the balancing, and you're showing the infinity sign that sometimes you're strong on the one side, sometimes you're strong on the other, but over time it evens out, right? And this is just a tangent here, but I'm gonna drop it anyway, which led me to see something and apply something in my life, which I call the Lennon-McCartney rule, which is Lennon-McCartney, they you won't find a Beatles song written by either of those two. There's no John Lennon song and there's no Paul McCartney song. There's always Lennon-McCartney songs. And the reason is that they spent so much time together that they couldn't disentangle who contributed what to any song. So they just said, let's slap both things on. Mm-hmm. And I adopted that as the Lennon-McCartney rule for any and every project I engage with. If I don't feel good about going in on equal terms, something's wrong. If the other side doesn't feel good about going in on equal terms, something's wrong. I shouldn't do that. So it's always, everybody has the same, if you talk about a company percentage or whatever in that organization, or voice or whatever, everybody has the same. And if that's not possible, then the whole project's not possible. Yeah. And I found that very, very powerful. But let's get practical here. So all of the things you've said, I fully understand. But then life hits, right? Like the Mike Tyson, my favorite philosopher, right, said, no plan survives a punch in the face. So the question is, how do you actually apply that in real life? You're wanting, you're sitting in your community, let's say, concrete example, small village in Germany, tiny, 40 people. How do you activate that? How do you actually get this moving into what you're describing so beautifully? How do you get the activation energy? What do you need to do as the person wanting to get that seen in your community?
There are so many ways. I think, for example, about work that I did 20 years ago in a small river town that I was living in that had 2,000 inhabitants across maybe about 7 or 8 kilometers, so sort of narrowly stretched out. This was a community that was in many ways suffering, struggling as a result of neoliberal pressures, and was hitting up against all sorts of structural racism internalized within the community. So like really, really challenging moment. I put out a little one pager of an idea to map community assets, put them into a physical directory of like passions, knowledge, skills people wanted to share and whether they wanted to charge, barter, gift, etc. I got 6 volunteers. We door knocked the whole town over the space of 2 weeks, put together a little booklet that I still have here somewhere that mapped 500 passions, knowledge, skills, resources in the community. Yeah, static, you know, things that might change rapidly. That's one example, right? Starting with what's working. It takes practice in my experience. I'm 28 years into this practice of asset-based approaches, and I'm still learning. It means that every time I am answering you and your questions here, how am I starting with strengths? Every time I start an article, every time I jump on a call with a colleague in another part of the world, how am I beginning with what's working to essentially co-regulate the experience, right? So practically, what do? You practice. And then you also realize, increase your radar to see how the framing almost everywhere pervasively is deficit, what you don't have. Look at, open any newspaper right now, any online newspaper, et cetera, any comment feed and, you know, social media, and you'll see people responding with deficit. Then put the pieces together and say, right, why? It's so obvious why things are devolving when we're all pushing each other out of co-regulation into this flight, fight, freeze, and fawn interactions and hoping that we can cross divides, build bridges. No, it doesn't work that way, especially when you add projected trauma into the space. And so what do? Take the time, slow down to start with strengths in any community building process.
Yeah.
Start from that practical space.
We sometimes use the idea of the 8 forms of capital, which you might be familiar with, Soloviev and Landua. But there are many forms of capital frameworks out there. And I just realized through our conversation today what this actually does, because it seems to be a very powerful approach, but now I understand what it does, which is it takes energy away from the deficit, showing the existing wealth. And that changes the conversation.
Yeah.
Right? By exploring that there might be a lot of cultural capital or intellectual capital or social capital where there might not be so much financial capital. Well, financial capital is just the ultimate abstraction into any other form of capital. So if you have all the others, you don't need financial capital. You're already wealthy.
Right.
And that changes the game completely.
Yeah. Yeah, there's one other question that I found in addition to exploring different forms of capital resources that exist. One other entry point question that I found to be the most powerful question that I can ask anyone when I'm coming together around some potential partnership or work-related activity. And that question is, what are you passionate about that has nothing to do with work? And the reason I sense that that question is so powerful is that if we come together to collaborate on a project, and I even ask you, you know, what are you passionate about this project? Mm-hmm. There is the possibility that we are going to move, because remember, we're talking about this pain point for a lot of people who are not feeling seen, that I am going to seek to, from a position of feeling disempowered and wanting to empower myself, present my credentials or something in a way that helps me feel that you are seeing me, which sets up a power dynamic from the outset. That's not a healthy space in most cases to start partnerships, right? Of like, you don't want to be entering into partnership with people feeling seen, which is to your point of like equal 50-50, you know, making sure that that's a way that you might name at the beginning, hey, if we work together, I just want you to know there's this equality that I bake in. Okay, great. That makes me feel a little more relaxed kind of thing, or curious. Mm-hmm. But this piece about non-work related passions is critical. Because in my experience, what it does is it rehumanizes our relationships. It moves, if we're caught up in transactionality, then one way to respond to transactionality is to slowly get to know each other as human beings before we move into the work.
Mm-hmm. And the work ultimately is a group of people trying to achieve something in the world. It's always helpful to remember that. For several reasons. One, because that means that everybody is valued in that process by definition, because we're only achieving it together. We're here in this group because we achieve it together. And once it's achieved, the dynamics change. We might not even need our group anymore. We can disband whatever that group was. But we can do this without fear because we have met each other as humans in that process, right? Not because we are running a company, but we're groups solving something, doing something.
Yeah. I would agree that that purpose, that collective purpose, can be a galvanizing force. And I have become increasingly curious about what I would consider another side, perhaps that's not the right framing, of the idea of doing things together. And that is, I'm most interested these days in how a group comes together and bees together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The doing bit often gets the emphasis, but how do we be together? That to me opens up a lot more of the mysteries that I find most exciting, because the doing, in my experience in the Post-Growth Institute, for example, and in other community projects, if you can be together and you can be on a journey of co-liberation about being, like sitting with the unknown, with the silence, with what's not clear, etc., the doing is easy. The doing is a natural flow on from working through that discomfort and going, okay, here we are, getting to know each other, getting to know where things land for us. And then with that safety of the intimacy that can come with that deeper connecting around being with each other, doing is often then just a case of running lean tests on experiments, you know, that you're wanting to put out into the world.
Couldn't agree more. I run a similar process with every team I initiate, which revolves around the dream of a good world on an individual and then collective level. And once that has happened, it is really clear what we're setting out to do together. Originally I started this as an exercise in optimizing towards not having to do micromanagement because I'm fundamentally lazy. So, but then it turned out into something more powerful. Right, because that actually creates a coherent group of people who know each other deeply and want to move towards something good that they share. But you and I are probably more on the extroverted level of things or side of things. For us, it's probably a little bit more easy than for many people, right? So what would you recommend as some steps for somebody who sees this need, somebody who listens to this and says, yeah, I want this, but I feel shy, or I don't feel I'm the person to initiate something like this. What would you give that person to encourage them and find the assets within them to start moving?
I love this question. I love it so much because it's a question I've been asked before and sitting with for some time, and I've run some experiments on, mm-hmm. on what I propose, and those experiments so far have come back as validating that what I'm going to say is helpful. So here we go. If you're someone who's perhaps would self-describe as on the more introverted end of the spectrum, and obviously that changes and, you know, there's nuance with these sorts of things, and you're in an organization where people with extroverted tendencies dominate, the one thing that I would recommend doing is finding the person you have the closest relationship with who holds the greatest level of power. Like, who is it that you're connected with that is in a greater position of power and perhaps privilege, and perhaps is more extroverted, who might be involved in facilitating spaces, etc., and proposing to them that the group or any group they're involved in, that you're involved in as well, trials a policy that after any question that is asked within the group that is not rhetorical, that the group will spend a set amount of time, 10 seconds, 20 seconds, a named amount of time, reflecting in silence. And mm-hmm. then at the end of that period, the facilitator will ask, would anyone like more time? And then wait to see if anyone responds. And then if not, move forward with the conversation. That simple approach, or approach that sounds simple, mm-hmm. I found that people who are more introverted have the enough confidence to ask that request, that if it gets adopted, what happens is it changes the dynamic by adding in the spaciousness. And the spaciousness is what's critical, because what a lot of extroverts in my experience don't realize is that introverts experience places, especially in spaces of activism, as very violent. Mm-hmm. And that violence is felt in their bodies, because when you don't have the space to actually connect with what you're feeling and noticing, and I would argue this is relevant for all of us, but particularly relevant for those who are in spaces where people just keep, hey, what should we do here? And boom, someone answers, right? Goes straight into, this is what we should do, etc. That's experienced often as violent. Right? Like, I'm getting attacked. There's no, and then you're not going to have any of that, what we're talking about in terms of what we want to bring forth. So that proposal is what I propose people take into their spaces. Propose that your organization, your activities, etc., respond to group questions like, what does everyone think about this? Let's now take 20 seconds to reflect silently on that question. 20 seconds later, would you like more time, etc.?
This is powerful. And I'm going to say something that is potentially offensive to extroverts, but I'm allowing myself to do this because I am potentially one, and you potentially are one too, or used to be, you said. There's a very interesting thing happening around the large language model trajectory, right? Large language models effectively are word dispensers. They just know what the next best word is to come out based on everything they have ingested. And I would say that more often than not, humans are also just word dispensers. And we don't do the actual thinking to come up with original, deep, new synthesis. Instead, we tend to just dispense the next couple of words that fits whatever is happening. And my argument here is that extroverts are just better at that. And introverts might just be the better thinkers for that reason, because they take time to actually integrate and not just dispense the next couple of words that make sense in this context.
Yeah. I would agree with all of that, and add a slight reframe for me, which is that it's It's the feeling that I find most interesting rather than the thinking. The feeling that connects with the thinking but remains in the feeling. So, for example, I led the development of a global macroeconomic post-capitalist market theory that is yet to be published in full, but explores what a post-capitalist market looks and feels like in practice and how we get there, building on existing strengths, etc. Almost all of that theory came out of an embodied exploration of what I was feeling, where it emerged from, rather than an intellect, like rather than my training, which was to intellectually grapple with fractional reserve systems and, you know, the corporation and limited liability and all these concepts, etc. Instead, just to let it come through the body. And so I agree with you, and I go one step further and say that, and maybe this was your point too, all of us benefit, right? When we create that space, all of us. But I would argue that we benefit most when we drop further into our body and have a, let's call it full body thinking for the sake of keeping with the same language, rather than a somewhat disconnected intellectualization of things.
There's actually, you might know him, and can't come up with the name of the person. He was a psychologist, philosopher.
Ian McGilchrist.
No, it's not Ian McGilchrist. It's a guy in the 80s, 90s in the US. He came up he found something he called focusing. I think it's not a very good word for what he was describing. But essentially he said, your body already knows what's going on. But it can only speak in binary language. It can only say yes or no. And the way your body says no is by giving you a, that's how he expressed it, thing, right? You feel, And if your body says yes, it goes like, relax. Yeah. And now with that as the only necessary knowledge, if you cultivate your sensitivity towards that language of your body, you can now enter a conversation with the unknown known that your body carries, but that's not part of your language.
Yeah.
And then you can ask your body questions. And you're a kinesiologist, right? You know that is true, right? You know that your body expresses yes and no's. And so in that conversation, people can very, very quickly get to the truth of what they are, what's true for them, right? And whatever their question is, their personal truth for their question. That's what I mean. Not an objective truth. And the really interesting point about this was that they found language patterns that were easily detectable that showed that people were doing this. And then they had students analyze psychology sessions with psychologists and like therapy sessions. And they found a correlation between people doing that, engaging in those language patterns that point at this practice of focusing, and therapy success, regardless of school of therapy, psychology that the therapist was coming from. And an inverse correlation, if you didn't do that, you wouldn't be as successful.
Yeah.
I find that extremely interesting, and it ties exactly into what you're saying.
Wow. Yeah, you're making me realize something about our own work in terms of how we hold discussions at the Post-Growth Institute. We encourage people to lead with proposals, right? Which is very unusual. Most conversations that I've been involved in over the decades in activist circles is like, hey, let's talk about this topic. And it's an open floor, like, you know, let's just start the conversation. We lead with proposals, and we encourage people to lead with proposals because of what you're describing. What's the embodied response? Is this in the ballpark? No, this is like totally off base to where what feels a yes or a no in my body, etc. So there's, I mean, the wonderful thing about all of this for me, Thomas, is there is so much that is possible when we create conditions and we continue to learn about what conditions people need for thriving, right? For the good life. And it's why I'm so obsessed with facilitation, because it's such an art, right? It's such a skill that requires dedicated feedback loops to be learning and remembering what works, what actually allows us to feel safe and seen as human beings in these spaces, what brings forth our creativity. I'm going to just be running an exercise in 40 minutes now, a test, a question that I surprised myself at realizing I have not asked this question in our organization for the last 15 years, and I'm surprised I haven't. And that is, what creative parts of yourself would you like to bring more fully into expression in this organization? And what would be needed in order for you to feel safe, able, et cetera, to do that? I'm excited to see what happens in 40 minutes with the results.
How big is that team?
That's 11 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We once did that in a similar group, a sized group, a different organization, where we went through a process of everybody defining their ultimate dream in life. And we put that into a huge shared office space on the wall for everybody to see what's everybody's dream in life. And that's changed so much.
Mm.
Just being in awareness. And it reminds me also of something I didn't understand until recently, which somebody, a concept that somebody gifted me about 22 years ago, which was Bernard Leiter. Bernard had been the head of the central bank in Belgium, and he had been the chief architect of the introduction of the euro. But most people know him as one of the central proponents of alternative currency systems. And Bernard used to love to tell the story about the city of Ghent, where they had a problem with illegal immigrants in one part of the city, with all of the devastation that comes with that, because people, if they're not legal, they cannot find jobs. Well, they don't have a lot of resources. So there's this whole emerging spiral of substance abuse, violence, desolation, etc. And they just didn't know how to help these people get out of that. And Bernard went in to ask the people, what do you dream of? What's your dream? And for some reason, most of the people responded with, we'd love to have a little piece of land. They want to grow something. So he got a piece of land and he created a currency that you could earn by doing nice things in your neighborhood, literally nice things, cleaning up, being nice, well, all of these things. And that was the only currency you could use to rent that piece of land. And so that changed the entire dynamic and people lifted themselves out, etc. And ultimately, that led to Bernard's big dream in life, which was, how about we create a central bank of dreams in which if you announce your big dream in life and I do something on the other end of the planet that somehow makes your dream bigger, that creates Donny token, because the backing of the Donny token just increased by means of your dream. And I receive some of that as an appreciation. Well, I won't be able to buy anything with that because nobody accepts Donny token, right? But I don't have to, because if everybody's in the process or in the game of fulfilling each other's dreams and their own dreams by means of fulfilling your own dream, right? Your own passions, then everybody has everything they need. And the only thing missing here is some materials. But if we find great ways, maybe in nature, to solve that, then we can live in true relational gift economy and abundance for all. And so I completely agree that that's the root needs to be in what's your biggest elevation of your dream? And how can we be in support of that?
Love it.
You mentioned in the very beginning that it's not about so much about story adding or shedding or even insights. It's more about remembering, right? And if you look at this space of the unknown knowns within us, based on your experience, what is your favorite memory in that space that you would like all of us on this planet to remember so that we can start moving into the direction of unlocking the kind of civilization and economy you are working on and are envisioning?
Well, in order to continue that unlocking, because I think that it's been in practice and it's been stewarded by many groups and cultures in an ongoing way, despite the pressures to eradicate the continuation of that journey. I would say, in truth, it's an experience that I've had with teams where conversations can be generative, even if they are perceived as otherwise. So, for example, I think I had a very intellectual approach to the idea of 1 + 1 = 3, can = 3. Right? I always thought that the notions of having individuals in a group to bring in their perspective, so to speak, was about this idea that we've each got things to add in terms of knowledge, right? Very sort of so you want to build something, you get an engineer in the room, you get a UX designer, you get someone who's interested or as an anthropologist works in particular, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? I was conditioned to feel that 1 + 1 = 3 because of the sum of the knowledges, and the unknown known that I have encountered through experiences with working with small groups of people using sociocratic decision makings that start with strengths-based approaches. So in other words, mm-hmm. we feel safe enough to drop into our bodies and connect with what we believe is our wisdom. And then someone proposes something, and then someone says, I have an objection. And we all go, ooh. And we hear what the objection is. And then I've seen everyone go, that's a great objection. And then someone else goes, I've got another objection. And then mm-hmm. someone, they put forward what that objection is. And we go, oh my, yeah, that makes sense too. Mm-hmm. What I have experienced in that process, the magic that I'm not doing a particularly good job on this call probably explaining, is that now I understand 1 + 1 = 3. Not being the sum of the knowledge in the space, but the sum of what happens when we are aided collectively in a process of reconnecting with what we all actually remember in our own bodies. Mm-hmm. Because what I saw is that the moment that others in the space recognized how something they were missing got brought forth, there wasn't the typical trauma response that I've noticed elsewhere previously, which is, oh, why didn't I think of that? Or, mm-hmm. you know, they're highlighting that what I proposed isn't good enough. It was mm-hmm. the opposite. It was this, wow, together we actually can come up with stuff that feels really good, is complex, nuanced, mm-hmm. right? Not mm-hmm. black and white, have all these, and then let's go test it to see, was it wisdom or projection? That is what I would want to leave with you, is keep going on that exploration of what is it that you don't necessarily, not just don't know, but also what haven't remembered, you have remembered, and then see how good it can feel when you feel safe enough to take in someone else's insights in a way that you then realize the generative power of what that means in a collective process.
And the precondition is, let's not take ourselves too seriously.
Oh, absolutely. You have to be having fun. At your learning edge, the Goldilocks zone, at your learning edge, not over or understimulated, and having fun. That's mm-hmm. going to get the dopamine response so you keep coming back to that generative practice for sure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Donnie. That was a really, really beautiful conversation. I took away so much, and I already know I will keep coming back to that conversation and to you a lot for learning more about how to do this properly, because you've clearly have accumulated a lot of wisdom around the question of how to help people get into coherence and then why, by not caring about the doing part, probably activating more doing than you would otherwise activate. So,
thank you, Thomas. I've remembered so many things during this call. I've been madly writing things down that this has helped me with. So, thank you.